are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
I'd really like, at the moment, to have a good chat to Taylor Swift.
I did not expect you to say that.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This is Holly, editor at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. The 2018 anniversary of the centenary of some women winning the right to vote in the UK inspired us to launch the 100 Women podcast series, in which we are interviewing 100 women working in the field of education or in the public eye in order to catalogue their lives, celebrate their successes, discuss the challenges they face, and discover what they would like to pass on to the next generation. In this week's podcast, you can listen to my interview with Deborah Kidd, teacher trainer and founder of Northern Rocks. Listen to us discuss the good and the bad about the education blogging and Twitter sphere, why it was time for Northern Rocks to finish and the new CPD project Deborah is launching, as well as how we can work towards creating a more diverse and inclusive representation of teachers online and at conferences.
So this is Holly, editor at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK, and today I'm interviewing Deborah Kidd. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Holly. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Can you introduce yourselves to our listeners and tell them what you do and where you do it?
Well, I'm Deborah Kidd, and I still think of myself as a teacher, although strictly speaking, because I'm not doing the grind of the day-to-day work, I probably shouldn't. So I think of myself as a travelling teacher, and what I do is I go to schools and I teach children with their teachers watching, and then we develop CPD out of those modelled sessions. That's how I spend most of my time, and I do it all over the world. So I could be in Singapore one day and Shanghai the next and Nottingham the next and Salford the next. It's literally literally global.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I like that phrase, job title, travelling teacher. And so what's your education background and the career path that led you to where you are now?
Well, I started off my life just in a normal 11 to 16 comprehensive school. It's the first year of comprehensive education, so all the years above me were in a secondary modern setting, and then we were the first year group that hadn't sat the 11 plus, and that was a bit of an eye-opener. And then in sixth form, I really wanted to do music A-level, so, and there wasn't really a provision locally for that, so my mum and dad put their hands in their pockets and they sent me to a private school, and were a little bit disappointed when I dropped the music A-level halfway through for various personal reasons. So that was in Blackburn in Lancashire, and from there I went to university and did an English degree and did a PGCE after a few years working in marketing and advertising in English and drama. So I trained as a secondary school teacher. My first job was in a sixth form college where I met my husband, and I was teaching A-level there. Then I wanted some more 11 to 16 experience, so I moved into a high school setting, worked in 11 to 16, got really involved in transitions of primary, and ultimately ended up teaching more in primary than in secondary. And apart from a few years working with universities and primary schools together, I've pretty much spent about 24 years in the classroom, and then suddenly left and became freelance. So, yeah, new world now.
What was it that made you leave?
It was a combination of factors. I think partly I was just getting curious and occupied with a broader picture than my own school setting, and that was starting to put pressure on my time. But ultimately, I was just dismayed. I think I was burned out, to be honest, but I was also dismayed at the amount of workload that was being spent on things that I didn't feel were necessary. And even worse, things that I felt were actually undermining the values and principles that I felt were important in the classroom. So, for example, data drops. I remember in the week I actually resigned, I'd spent 15 hours trying to make a spreadsheet turn the right colour. And I knew that if I was honest, the unit of work the students had just done was much harder than the previous unit of work. And so in terms of linear progress, they probably would have looked like they'd taken a step back. But the spreadsheet doesn't allow that. And if it turned red, if I put the honest marks in, I would have then had to do an individual action plan for each one of those students, which there was just no way I could do it in terms of time. So I lied. I changed the marks. And I just started to think we were living in a farcical situation, and I just couldn't really stay in it.
Mm-hmm. What a shame. Do you think that's the case for lots of teachers at the moment?
I think it is. I think when teachers talk about workload, I'd say the vast majority of them really don't mind any amount of workload that they feel is acting in the benefits of the students that they teach. But there's a large amount of surveillance-related workload linked to accountability, linked to fear, coming from, I wouldn't even say coming from senior management down, it's coming right from the fear that's placed on the senior management down. So it's coming from right from the top of the system. And that is that surveillance-led, data-driven workload, I think, is putting a lot of teachers off teaching.
Yeah. What do you think the solution is? Big question.
Well, I think there's a really simple solution, and it's trust. It's about trust. It's about professional trust. It's about trust-based leadership, where everybody in the system is prepared to acknowledge a level of tolerance for mistakes and errors, and that we shift a culture away from punitive accountability to supportive accountability. Mm-hmm. So if you see a school that's struggling, you put systems in place to support that school rather than, putting a grade on it that instantly means that people are fearful for their jobs and that this school's survival is suddenly under threat because publicly it seems that people might not want to send their children there. I just think we have a very, very punitive system at the moment.
Okay. Let's move on to something more positive.
What career achievement are you most proud of?
I think, there's not a one most proud moment. I think it's when you see students in the supermarket 10 years after you taught them, or even, I saw a student the other day who is a parent sending her child to the school that I used to work in. And they come over and they hug you and they tell you that you had an impact on their lives. And these are not single achievements. They're just like, moments that make you feel that what you do was really important. Mm-hmm. And that's far, far better than any accolade or award or qualification.
And can you tell me a little bit more about Northern Rocks, what it was or is, for our listeners, why you started it and I think why you ended it, right?
Yeah, I did. Yes, I'm already missing it, actually. Yeah. I started it because as a teacher, I was in school and I was really frustrated at the lack of access to CPD that I felt would be relevant to me. Mm-hmm. And I was used to doing that thing that all teachers do, sitting through an inset day where, the message that you're receiving is something that you already understand and already know and already put into practice, but you still have to spend the day doing it. Or worse, that you sit there receiving inset training on something that you don't agree with or isn't relevant to your practice. Other things were starting to bubble up on Saturdays and Twitter was taking off and blogging was taking off and there were these kind of networks building up that were really interesting. And I spoke to Emma Hardy, who's now an MP, but she was an infant school teacher at the time, and we decided to put our own event on with the absolute principle that it was by teachers, for teachers. It was cheap, it was accessible, it was going to be fun, it was going to be feel like a day that people just really enjoyed, and they could have a tailor-made experience because there would be enough variety of workshops for them to be able to choose their own CPD pathway through it. And it worked. It was absolutely fantastic. For 5 years, we just had the best time. But the idea took off, of course, and now every Saturday there are probably 4 or 5 events. And I'd started to notice that not only were the same speakers rotating around those events, which, is challenging for the speakers themselves because nine times out of ten, they're not getting paid. But also the people, I started noticing things on Twitter from people saying, I've got small children, or I'm caring for elderly parents, or I'm just too tired, or I'm really skint and I can't afford even £25 for a ticket. And that sense of, are we creating a hierarchical structure here, where those who have fewer responsibilities, more time and more money are getting better training and more access to training than those who don't. So it became a bit of an ethical dilemma. And so I decided to stop it. Mm-hmm. So instead, one of the things I thought we could do is have a National Teacher Learning Day. And this is what I'm working on at the moment. And the idea is the first one will be on the 3rd of July 2020, because that gives head teachers a little bit of time to foreplan their inset days. From a head teacher's point of view, you'd be making a commitment to release your staff on that day for one of your designated inset days. And the only principle underpinning that is that they have individual free choice to attend an event they want. We're then putting on a range of events all around the country, and they will be catered for every sector from early years right through to FE. And teachers can sign up to them, and any event organiser can put one on, but the maximum ticket price has to be £40. And already we're getting some event organisers saying they'll do them for free. And what that means is it becomes affordable for the school. So the school can send all their staff out to training, but there's still that level of autonomy and choice over the package that you're getting. So fingers crossed, that'll come off.
And that sounds like a lot of work for you.
It's an awful lot of work, and I am trying to pull in people to help, and especially on the technical aspect of things, because, you know, just getting an app up and a website up where people can just search for the event they want and book it is a bit of a challenge. But yes, we'll get there.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely fantastic. What a great idea. And so you mentioned there about Twitter and blogging. I wanted to ask you about that, because obviously you're a very successful blogger have a good following on Twitter. And there's no doubt that Twitter and blogging has changed teacher CPD and networking, as you said. Do you think it is a force of good, or are there negative sides to the teacher Twitter sphere?
Oh, there are definitely negative sides. But I think on the whole, it's forced for good. I think it's forced debate and conversation. It's encouraged. And I think, you know, there's evidence, significant evidence, that it's encouraged government and Ofsted to engage with teachers a lot more directly. And even if, you know, Nick Gibb cherry picks the ones who agree with him and shares their views, even that, which, you know, you could question the bias there, it still encourages debate because people respond to it and answer and argue with it. So on the whole, I think it's been really good. And certainly, you know, from my point of view in the work that I'm doing now, it's a really useful tool. It can become really entrenched and divisive. And I think for new teachers, a lot of new teachers on Twitter have come on and said, I don't say anything because there are certain people who will leap on my comments and I'll feel humiliated and I know it's not good for my mental health. And I just recommend with those people that they either mute or they block or they just lurk and learn and, you know, read the blogs and read the things that resonate for them. But I wouldn't recommend for people to just turn away from that. I think there are ways of managing your timeline so that it's healthy for you.
Yeah.
But on the whole, yeah, it's been a force for good.
And I wondered if you thought there was an equal gender split and representation online.
I think it's getting better. It's getting a lot better. I remember when I first set up Northern Rocks, I was so grateful when speakers volunteered to speak, for example, that I didn't even think about gender representation, race representation. I was just like, oh, thank God we've got these speakers. That was my... And rightly, after the first year, I was pulled up on that and people, you know, pointed out that 70% of our speakers had been male, it had been almost 100% white, and it hadn't crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. And I think in the day-to-day, I suppose, interactions you have, I think there's a human a tendency, perhaps, to flock towards people who are familiar to you. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it really made me think, and it made me look more closely. And of course, there were loads of women out there. There were loads of, you know, people from a whole range of ethnic backgrounds out there. Loads of people with loads of different experiences. I hadn't seen them. Mm-hmm. I hadn't noticed them. Mm-hmm. And it's not until you kind of accept your own biases and your own, not prejudices, but blindnesses, you know, areas of blindness, that you start to look. And I think people are starting to do that. And I think Women Ed and BAME Ed and all those kinds of organisations at the moment are starting to make people look, and that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, no.
And that representation will improve. But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt there has been a heavily white male bias to a lot of this work.
If there was one thing you could change in education, what would it be?
Oh, I think the one thing I'd change in education is fear of the future. I think our whole system is predicated on being fearful about a future, fearful that we won't compete in the future globally with other countries, fearful that our students are somehow falling behind, fearful that, you know, even parents at a parental level, fearful that your child won't be successful and won't have their own home and won't fall in love. And all these things are downward pressures that are placed on children. And I think if we just shifted one thing and we thought, what's happening now at this moment in this classroom with these children, and how do we make this moment matter to them? Our whole education system would shift in a positive direction.
And what does the centenary of women getting the vote mean to you?
I think, you know what, Emma, it reminds me, is it wasn't that long ago. We think of it as a massively momentous thing, this historical event. And then, you know, when I consider it, I think actually that was in my grandmother's lifetime. Mm-hmm. And we have to be really careful not to take it for granted, because so many things that have been won in the past century are potentially a threat again. Mm-hmm. So I think what it means to me is don't be complacent. Yeah. Be grateful, but don't be complacent.
Yeah. And so that we can continue building like a more equal gender split online and speakers at conferences, what advice would you like to give to women who would like to take part?
I think it's that lean in advice, you know, in a way. And yes, I understand all the counter arguments to that about women shouldn't be having to lean in because it should be a fair world. But I know I have been my own worst enemy so many times by not putting myself forward for jobs because there was like a single bit of the criteria I didn't think I fit, or feeling like I was too ambitious, or that people would look upon me as being grabby in some way. And I don't think men have those thoughts, because I think we bring up boys to push forward and be ambitious and, you know, chase their dreams in a way that we don't with women so much. So I think on the whole, the world needs to change in terms of accepting that perhaps women won't always put themselves forward, so that perhaps there does need to be a little bit of, come on, you are good enough and we want to hear from you. Do you know what I mean? There need to be spaces and opportunities opened up. Yeah. And that's not patronising. I think it's just necessary.
Unfortunately it is, but yeah, I think it's great advice. Thank you. So finally, I'm going to move on to our quick fire round. Firstly, okay, if you hadn't become a teacher, what might you have become?
Well, I was already working in advertising, and then I realised you didn't get to choose your client, so I dropped that. I would have loved to have been a musician. I would have loved to have been a classical pianist. I just wasn't good enough.
Great answer. Name three famous women, dead or alive, you would like to invite to a dinner party.
Three famous women. I would like to speak to Queen Elizabeth I, because she's depicted in two such contradictory ways. I'd love to know which was the real her.
Good one.
I would absolutely love to meet a writer called Zora Neale Hurston, who kind of set the ball rolling on Black American women's literature, and her work is just beautiful, and I would have loved to. She died in poverty in the end, and I would have loved to have met her. Yeah. I'd really like, at the moment, to have a good chat to Taylor Swift.
I did not expect you to say that.
Really? I'm just intrigued at the moment that she's finally found this political voice, yeah, and what's instigated that and how it's impacting on her. I'd really like to talk to her about that.
Great answer. Okay, and what are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading Melissa Benn's book on National Education Service and the case for it and the argument for it. And I think it's really important because we're so preoccupied with Brexit, and there are so many things going on in the world at the moment, that I think some of these really good, genuine policy ideas that are being put forward by Labour are being largely ignored. So it's making me think a lot more deeply about that.
And finally, which woman would you recommend we interview next, and why?
I think should interview Melissa Benn.
Good one.
Currently reading right now. I think you'd find her answers very interesting.
That's really great. Oh, thank you so much, Deborah. It's been fantastic to talk to you.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye now.
You are listening to Teacher Toolkit. You can find out more about 100 Years, 100 Women on our website, teachertoolkit.co.uk, or follow us on social media using the hashtag TTKit100Women.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.